Revenue Committee, and welcome everybody here this morning. We've got a few bills up for some different action today, but let's begin with the work session on House Bill 2186. So we'll start with that. Elizabeth, we have several amendments here. If you would please walk us and talk us slowly through them so that we understand exactly what we're looking at.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. Let me start just with this handout here. I've just summarized there the four specific amendments that are before you. We've got the, now with House Bill 2186, this is the Reconnect Bill. We've discussed it several times before. But with this Dash 1 amendment, what we're doing, as we had talked about with this one before, it's establishing a date certain connection now to federal law changes pertaining to taxable income as of December 31st, 2002. So this is really trying to get at the issue of the any changes that the federal government would make pertaining to taxable income. You would come in then at the beginning of next session in 2005 and begin to go through all those federal law changes, and you would make a distinct decision at that time whether to connect with those changes. So that's basically what the Dash 1 amendment is doing, as opposed to having the rolling reconnect that we have in law now to federal taxable income. Now, the Dash 3 amendment is very similar to your Dash 1 amendment, except that what it's also doing is establishing a date certain connection to federal law changes pertaining to taxable income as of December 31st, 2002. But then it also reestablishes the rolling reconnect for changes in federal law pertaining to taxable income after December 31st, 2005. So if you remember, we had discussions at the last meeting about the chair saying he wanted to come in 2005 and revisit this issue of whether or not to keep a date certain connection to federal law definition of taxable income. So what the Dash 3 is going to do is then if the committee in 2005 decides that they do not want to have the rolling reconnect be established again, then you would go in 2005 and make those changes. Because with the Dash 3 amendment, you would be having the rolling reconnect go forward then for all federal law changes after December 31st, 2005. Now, the Dash 4 amendment, to kind of switch gears, the Dash 1 and Dash 3 are really dealing with what policy you want to have in connection with the taxable income and whether or not you want to have the rolling reconnect in the future. And so either the Dash 1 or Dash 3, if you want to address that issue and you change from the rolling reconnect under current law, you would need one of those amendments. Now, with the Dash 4 amendment, this is dealing with the issue that there are some specific elements of taxable income that need to be addressed and really would make it much easier to administrate, as well as make it easier for taxpayers in filling out their forms if we continued the rolling reconnect in certain areas. So what the Dash 4 amendment is doing is it is expanding on the Dash 2, and that's why you don't have a Dash 2 in front of you. But it basically is continuing the rolling reconnect to changes in federal law for certain elements of taxable income. And the ones that we have identified in the Department of Revenue and the CPAs were involved in that identification of some of these elements. First of all, is things like depreciation and expensing, the 179 expensing. And again, those are ones that, like in the Bush plan, there is a change in the 179 expensing. So this is something that potentially could be changed from federal legislation, and we would have this rolling reconnect because it would make it very difficult for taxpayers, businesses, and things to have to keep two sets of books on their depreciation between federal law and state law. So there's the issue of keeping the connection and having a rolling reconnect for depreciation, and then also issues like pension and employee stock ownerships, deferred compensation, IRAs, medical savings account, educational IRAs, and qualified tuition savings accounts. So these are all different situations in which you would be setting up an accounting difficulty for most taxpayers to keep track of how much they could contribute at the federal level versus how much they could at the state level, and this will just save a lot of different headaches for taxpayers in figuring out their taxes for these particular issues. And they're also ones that were brought forward initially in the Bush plan as things that that potentially could be in his federal law tax changes for 2003. So we wanted to make sure those were addressed and brought forward as things that would be in the Rolling Reconnect. Now, with the Dash 5, there's just one further issue that was brought up when we looked at some of Bush's proposed plan for 2003. And one element of his plan was to provide federal law to allow a different filing deadline for electronic filers. It was going to extend the filing deadline like from April 15th for tax purposes to April 30th for those who are electronic filers. And that was just something that he wanted to do, I would imagine, to encourage people to file electronically. So what the Department of Revenue brought forward is that would make it very difficult for them to administer a tax deadline for electronic filers that was different in Oregon state law versus at the federal level. So this was to then provide the Department of Revenue with rulemaking authority to prescribe a different tax deadline date in Oregon for these electronic filers if the federal government extended that federal tax due date. So it was just trying to make Oregon state law consistent with federal law if there was federal law changes to change that electronic date or change that due date for electronic filers. So those are the four amendments. Again, the Dash 4 and the Dash 5 do not consider any of the date certain connection dealing with taxable income. So you would need a Dash 1 or a Dash 3 in addition to the Dash 4 and 5 if you wanted to establish a date certain bill.
Madam Chair. None of these conflict with each other, is my understanding, right?
Wonderful.
So they all. And is there any fiscal impact of any of these sort of non-connect amendments?
Representative Haas, first of all, with the Dash 1 and the Dash 3, you've got to choose one or the other. Okay.
Right, I understand.
Yeah, okay. So the Dash 3 just kind of expands on the Dash 1. Now, with the Dash 4 and the Dash 5, no, because Dash 4 is really just keeping with current law. Since our current law is the Rolling Reconnect, we are basically still just allowing that Rolling Reconnect to connect for other of these specific changes in taxable income. And as far as the revenue impact, we discussed that before, and as of again today, we don't have any federal law passed yet. So there still would be no revenue impact on this bill, no matter what amendments you take or don't take. And then I did give you just a quick summary again. You had this sheet before, but basically, if you took like the Dash 1 or the Dash 3 in addition to the Dash 4 and 5, then basically what you're doing, if the federal government was to pass some of the different provisions that were being discussed, you could see then some positive feedback effects, because what you're basically doing when you're going to have a date-specific connection, then you're not going to capture any dividends losses, if it was like 50% taxation on dividends, then that would be if under current law, that's an automatic reduction in Oregon's taxable income. But with this date specific, then you would not be eliminating, there would not be that loss then in taxable income from that removal of the dividends. So what you would be seeing then is if the federal government still has some of the tax credit accelerations in the plan, which seems to still be a part of the component anyway of the compromise that's going on in Washington, you would see some positive impact from that. So it really, when you're having a rolling reconnect still to the depreciation issue, if there still is 179 expensing that is allowed to increase for corporations, that would be a loss to our taxable income, but you've got some positive feedbacks that still appear to be larger than what would be the negative from the 170, the negative loss from the 179 expensing threshold. But really, I haven't had a chance to really look at what came out of the Senate as far as reductions. It seemed like what came out of the House was pretty close to what Bush's original plan was. So I think, you know, we really just need to examine that further, what are going to be some of the positive feedback effects that would come to Oregon from, again, reduction in federal taxable liability.
Thank you. If I could follow up.
Yes, Representative Mass.
Dash 3 then, is that similar then to would that act like a sunset? That we'd have this, we're going to disconnect, but then we'll reconnect?
Prospectively.
Now, I'm just wondering where that idea came from or how or what that...
Well, you know, the thing is, this has been in here so long, I forget. I think it might have been mine. I think as a recognition of that we made a policy decision in 1997 to stay connected, that we're looking at this because we are in a recession. Congress has gone into a deficit strategy that we can't follow along. And I think I suggested this as a way of recognizing that our preference would, for a matter of convenience to taxpayers and predictability in our own Oregon income tax code, this recognizes that our preference would be connection. And so this is just a way, like a sunset, of revisiting the issue in 2 years' time.
Okay.
But in such a way that it's a 16 and 31 vote either way, as opposed to making it an 18 and 36
that was
although we could still do that.
We could still do it, but it's just like you don't need a sunset because you can always repeal any bill every session. This just will bring the issue back up for reconsideration in the next session, and we can take a look at where we are. And in fact, I will say that moving prospectively like this, if Congress takes action, which I'm going to predict is likely, while we are still in session, there is nothing to say, and I will say that it's highly probable, then as we put the budget together and look at our own revenue situation and our own revenue priorities, there may be pieces of what is coming out of Congress that we will want to reconnect to even yet in this session. But this gives us the ability then to set our own priorities in doing that, even yet this session, as opposed to adopting this pig in a poke, so to speak, and then having to hope that we have room to accommodate, in addition to that, whatever our own priorities might be. That satisfy?
Yeah, okay. That makes sense. If you look at it as a sunset,
That's essentially what it is. It's an inverse sunset.
We call that a sunrise.
A sunrise.
Except in the legislature.
An inverse sunset.
Okay, I missed most of the discussion. Are there other questions? You've gone through the amendments?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we are in work session. Let's take these one at a time. Okay. The chair would move adoption of one amendment to House Bill 2186. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I move adoption of...
He just moved
the dash ones. Oh, okay.
The dash one amendments. Sorry. Okay. Is there any discussion? Any objection? All right. The dash one amendments are in. Yes. The dash three amendments. Chair would move the adoption of the dash three amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Dash 3 amendments are in. Chair would move adoption of the Dash 4 amendments. Is there any discussion on those? Any objection? Dash 4 is in. Chair would move adoption of the Dash 5 amendments. Is there any discussion? Deborah, do you want to say anything about the Dash 5s? No, I'm going to say I missed the discussion. Is everybody comfortable on Dash 5s? All right. Is there any objection to the Dash 5s? Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Five's in. Representative Williams.
I'd move House Bill 2186 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2186 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chairman, can I just say one thing?
Yes.
The language in Dash 1 and the Dash 3 are slightly different, and so, if you really most of the concept in the dash one is in the dash three, so it would better just to choose one. I mean, unless you don't care how council kind of reconciles those.
But wait a second, then let's go back.
It is a little bit different.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I think you said you had to choose.
I thought it was between the dash one or dash three. Just because the dash three doesn't exactly, it's not word for word right in the dash three.
Well, let's go back before we move the bill out. Elizabeth, help us. We got
Just I think you could rescind your decision on the dash one and then just keep all the others.
Mr. Chairman, I will withdraw my motion.
All right. Thank you. Representative Williams withdraws his motion for 2186 to the floor. So we have before us then the consideration of the dash threes and ones. So you're saying the threes subsume the ones.
Correct.
Okay. And then they add the December 31, 2005 date. Okay.
So I'd move the withdrawal of the dash one amendments.
Representative Williams moves that we we haven't closed the work session, that we withdraw the dash one amendments from House Bill 2186. Is there any objection to that motion? All right. And the dash one amendments are out of 2186. So we have before us 2186 with the dash threes, the dash fours, and the dash fives. Representative Williams.
Now I would move House Bill 2186 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2186 as amended, once again for clarification, by the three, four, and five amendments. Is there any discussion on that motion? Appreciate the committee's combination of patience and willingness to move ahead with this. This is by the end of the session, this will not seem like a tough
vote.
but I understand that for several, it is a difficult choice right now. That said, is there any further discussion on House Bill 2186? Representative Berger?
I would just like to say that under most normal circumstances, I probably would not be in favor of such a bill.
Under normal circumstances, this bill wouldn't be before us.
Right, and under these circumstances, I must be in favor of it.
Thank you. Anything else? All right, please call the roll, Kathy.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Do we have a
Aye.
Aye.
Half?
Aye.
Hopkins?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
Aye.
Chair Shetterly?
Aye. House Bill 2186 will go to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation, recording Representative Scott and Representative Barnhart as excused, and I'll carry it. Okay. Close the work session on House Bill 2186. Let's go to House Bill 2705. Open the work session on that. Well, we've got some amendments, and Tom Pekowski here. Tom, do you want to come forward?
Mr. Chair, I have actually two amendments, although one of the amendments is to Senate Bill 601, but Senate Bill 601 is identical to 2705, so it actually is is relevant for this bill. The 2705-1 amendments are based on the public hearing you had, a discussion particularly with the Department of Administrative Services Director Gary Weeks, and we've worked with Tom Pitowski on these. It does several things. First of all, there on line 2 of the -1 amendments, it just changes the recommendation on the part of the board to be persons rather than person. Okay. And this was a request of DAS so the governor would have some choice and would not basically be confronted with an either with a rejection or acceptance. So that makes that clear. And line 5 on the dash ones are the same thing. The main thing that the amendment does, though, is it deletes the section 5 in the original bill, lines 20 through 31. And what that was doing was setting up this revenue forecast advisors which would have a role of advising the state economist on the revenue numbers. I think there was concern expressed on the part of the committee as well as DAS that there were multiple committees being formed. So this would not be formed in statute, and it is something that the Office of Economic Analysis is currently moving toward, and Tom can address some of the plans he has. As you recall, the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors reviews the economic forecasts. That's created by an executive order. But they review the economic forecasts and have expressed some interest in expanding that role, or at least some of them, in terms of reviewing the revenue numbers as well. So there would be an analysis of the preliminary revenue numbers and give Tom some feedback on those numbers. So that was the intent here, and the sense is that can be done without creating a statutory committee. So those are the key elements of the Dash 1 amendments. The 601-2 amendments, Senate Bill 601, which was heard in Senate revenue yesterday, is, as I say, the identical bill, original bill, the House Bill 2705. And these amendments were brought forth by Senator Beyer, and I was hoping he would be able to come by. But
have we tried to reach him?
I talked with him yesterday, and I talked to him this morning.
Kathy, do you want to just give his office a call, see if he might be reachable? Go ahead.
I can describe the intent here of the 601-2. The Senator Beyer was really, to the extent possible, given the constraints we have, to set this up similar to the Washington Forecast Council. And remember, you were given kind of a description of that when we originally looked at House Bill 2705. But what this would do is create the forecast board, just as 2705 does, but it would create four of the six positions would be legislative appointed. They would be legislators. So they would be appointed by the Senate President and by the Speaker, and one from each party, from each chamber. And the other element here involved in this amendment would be on line 15 of the amendment, there's an additional responsibility for the forecast board, and that is about halfway through the sentence there, to provide advice too. So they would be a more active role than is in the other 2705 and in the Dash 1 amendments to 2705. So the state economists would present the results to this board, and then they would approve it. Now, if you look at the Washington Forecast Council, they do require approval of the forecast by a vote of four of the six members.
Mr. Chairman, you're losing us in part over down at this end of the table because
we're reading ahead.
Because we're looking at Section 7 of the 601 amendments that talks a lot about DUII cases, and the court shall not exercise authority under this subsection during any period that they have notice from the state economist that there aren't sufficient monies in the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund. And I think we're just all sort of
interlock device.
We're all sort of lost.
We were wondering if it was April 1st, and we were.
Tom, we didn't know you had control over that. We want to bring you up to the Judiciary Committee every afternoon and start talking to us about this. So,
but Representative Wayne, what you're saying is it's not clear the connection between the DUI fund and the state economist.
Well, actually, it's more clear than I'd like it to be. That's part of the problem.
Forecasting.
You could go a long way on
that. Oh, we got to laugh, Tom.
And so do you. That's over.
I like how it's going to be paid from the Intoxicated Driver Program.
Okay. you all are very bad mystery readers. Turn back to the beginning of the book, and we'll get there.
I'll get there to page two, and that is that one final thing, though, about the Washington Forecast Council is that they do require an approval of this council, the forecast, and state economist presents an optimistic and pessimistic and then what he considers the most likely forecast. In the history of the council, which goes back to 84, I think, they've always approved what the recommended forecast was. So there hasn't been a time when the council has voted a different forecast. So that's kind of how that's worked in practice. On the page two, the reason for the reference here to the DOI fund and is that Senator Beyer was concerned about there being some confusion with creating a statutory position of state economist and now the existing Office of Economic Analysis, in which Tom is the head of, and DAS, concerned about there being some confusion and possibly two operations or two offices. So that's why he recommended this removal of it. And as Dexter was going through the statutes, he found that there's only one reference to the Office of Economic Analysis, which is in the DAS, and that is to review this DUI fund, which I actually did spend a fair amount of time one interim working on. So that is the only reference, and that is the reason for that change to state economist from the Office of Economic Analysis.
Very funny. Okay. So we have the dash ones, the dash twos. They are entirely alternative.
Yes, they are alternative approaches. Yes.
I guess we could move them both, but we can move one without the other, and neither is subsumed within the other. So, Tom, welcome back.
Welcome.
Do you want to talk to us about where we are on this?
Yes. Morning. For the record, my name is Tom Potowski, State Economist, Office of Economic Analysis. Appreciate the opportunity today to come before you to give some information. The process that we're at the moment is formulating this sort of technical revenue advisory committee, something we had talked about in the past. I've contacted our Council of Economic Advisors, our chair, Ralph Shaw. He's given me some recommendations. What we're seeing is this committee, and we want to make sure that the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, they have a very important function, and we have some of the brightest and best people that know about the economy is on this council. And they've also shown some interest in knowing more about how the revenue forecast takes place. As you recall, the process is we have the economic forecast, and once those numbers are finalized, the results from that forecast then also affect then the revenue forecast. So it's been a sort of a step process that we've gone through in the past. In the past, though, most recently, we have presented our revenue methodology to the Governor's Council. We've discussed more revenue issues with them, and they seem very interested in wanting to expand out their function in order to deal with that. So we're going to move forward, regardless of outcomes of any of the bills, to formulate this committee. We're looking at the composition of basically being some specialists in tax law, we think would be very useful, tax manager from a large corporation, possibly high-tech area. I'll be contacting Jim Craven from OEA and probably Bill McKenzie from Intel for some suggestions on that. And then possibly also a tax practitioner. If we could find someone that does the Blazer players, that might be. The idea here is that, you know, when you have the top 25% of the income distribution pays about 75% of the taxes, having some knowledge of their behavior that it may not be picked up historically but is presently happening would be of some value to our forecast. And then just forecasting specialists like those that are on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, those members, some of those that would be interested in being on this committee, we'd also have involved. So that's the approach that we're moving in right now that I think is very similar to this procedure.
Okay. Well, let's if you'll stay where you are, let's welcome Senator Beyer to Revenue Committee. Well, I'm happy to have you here. And we've got your dash two amendments to Senate Bill 601, which Paul has walked us through from just the staff overview. And so we've had a rundown on them, but happy to have your comments and testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I appreciate your willingness to look at my ideas for what is Senate Bill 601, which is a carbon copy to your bill 2705. and I'm glad you already have a copy of the amendments, and I have not seen the amendments to your bill, so I don't know exactly how they differ from what I have proposed. But I think that, as I said yesterday in the hearing on 601, I think 2705 are both attempts to get the most accurate forecast possible and to not politicize forecasts. I think that's extremely important. We don't want that happening. But what we do want, because Representative Shetterly and myself have been in the process for the same length of time, and we have yet to see a forecast that is within 2% in our legislative history. And so we've either, three of them have been on the plus side. Unfortunately, this time is a different situation. But if you go back through the 1990s, there has not been a forecast yet that has been within 2%. And I recognize the difficulty there is in getting to that level, but the most accurate forecast we can get is will help all of us in the process, both the executive branch, the legislative branch, everyone will benefit. So the idea that I have is to get more legislators involved and get them involved in a way they can offer advice, not just receive a report. And I think that will help. And, of course, we're bound by our Constitution. All we can offer is advice. We cannot, have, what's the word? We can't be part of the process legally, but we can at least give advice and counsel. And I would hope that you would look favorably on that concept. I don't believe we need two offices. That's why my amendments eliminate the other one. And I don't care which way we go on that. It's we don't need a duplication of effort there. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions I could from the committee on my approach, kind of talk about the differences between my approach and what you guys have come up with, because I have not seen that.
Yeah, ours actually the -1 amendments to 2705 are narrower substantially than yours. It does eliminate our -1 amendments eliminate the Council of Revenue Forecast Advisors as being unnecessary. The other main change is the recommendation of more than one person to the governor to serve as state economist. So it really doesn't address the part of the bill that you're amending principally with the makeup of the forecast board. So we can talk about yours separate from ours. Questions for Senator Beyer? Representative Berger?
Hi, Senator Beyer, thank you. I'm a little curious as to how you see this as lessening the political climate of this board by adding these changes. Do you see this as making it less political?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I do, and I know a lot of people say bringing legislators in is going to make it more political.
Yeah.
But I see it because you've got equal number of legislators from the House and from the Senate, and equal number of each party, of two of the greatest, two members from each of the largest two caucuses. And we had to word it that way because we don't know if we will always be Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah, right.
But I guess I will go to my experience when I was at the Pacific Conference this last December. I met with a senator there from Washington who has always been in the minority party until now. He is now chairman of their Ways and Means Committee, but until this session, he has always been in the minority. And he's the one that brought this to my attention, how they do it. And if you look, I showed this yesterday. I don't know if you've seen this graph. This is a graph of Washington's state's forecast versus actual collections of revenues. And if you look, the two lines are virtually on top of each other. And in Washington, this committee not only gives advice to the forecast, it actually chooses the forecast, if it cannot, by a group, and it's four legislators and two appointees of the governor in Washington. And they are given a range of numbers, of forecast possibilities, and a number that the economist thinks will be the number. And this committee actually has the option to choose from that range. And if they cannot choose within a certain time period, then the economist's forecast becomes the forecast. And what he has told me as a member of the minority party up until now is that this process has worked very well, and it does take politics out of it because it brings the perspective of people from across the state in, from both parties in, and they look at it and they can decide, you know, what they think is the best number that reflects what's going to be the true what's happening in the state of Washington. And that's the only thing I can go on is his experience, because obviously we don't do it that way in Oregon. Yeah. But when I saw their number, and what also really brought this forward to me was that I asked him then, I said, what's Washington's forecast? And this was back in January. I said, what's Washington's forecast for the next biennium? And he said, we're expected to grow at about 7%. I don't know what if they've changed it. They should have changed it by now, because they meet every quarter just like our forecasts come out. I said, that's interesting, because at that time we had 14% at that time. Now we're at about 10.5. We then checked into the state of California. And California, which budgets on an annual basis, not biennial, but their forecast was a negative growth for the 03 fiscal and a slight positive growth for the 04 fiscal, which came to about a 2% growth for the biennium. So we got Washington at 7%, California at 2%, and we're at 14%. I said, something's got to be wrong, or we in Oregon have really figured out how to grow our economy. I don't know which it is. I'm hoping it's the latter, but I'm not convinced of that yet. So that's what made me think that there's got to be a better way to do it, and the Washington model seems to be working well for them. If you look at that chart, that's a time period from July of 2000 until November of 2002.
Okay. I guess one question I would just about that chart. Each state's revenue system being different, is Washington's easier to forecast than Oregon's because of the nature of the revenue system?
Well, as we saw in the chart we looked at in Washington's growth over recent biennia, the sales tax is clearly more inelastic, and that's why you would expect to see lower growth, as 7% would be something you'd expect to see that's lower. But I would not say anything is easy to forecast. That's definitely, and their sales tax base includes a fair amount of things that are volatile. They're business-type expenditures, consumer durables. So there are volatile components to the sales tax, but it is not as volatile as the income tax.
If I may add, the committee, for information purposes, I talked to the senior economist of the state of Washington late last night, and the graph that you're showing of the accuracy is based on a one quarter ahead forecast only.
Okay.
So they just went, and then they take, like we do, we readjust the forecast and then we see what happened for that quarter. So we have one page in our booklet that we publish that shows that one quarter tracking, and that's just a tracking of that one quarter over time.
Okay.
The senior economist said that they've definitely been outside of the 2% range for quite a few bienniums in the past.
Okay.
On either side.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I would say it was narrower than our error, and I think that is related to the nature of their tax structure, a little more stable, though still very difficult to forecast relative to the income tax.
All right. Any other conversation, questions, comments for either Senator Beyer or Mr. Potowski? My inclination, since we just saw these for the first time this morning, is to kind of let this sit right now. We'll bring this back up. Would there be a chance of getting a hand-engrossed version of the bill? It would be helpful with these two amendments in here to get a sense of if we could do a hand-engrossed.
Okay,
if we could see a hand-engrossed.
Sure.
That'd help.
Okay, then bring it back.
Then bring it back. Okay, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. All right, let me close the work session then on House Bill 2705. And let's take up House Bill 2043. Open a work session on House Bill 2043. Who does that give us? Lizbeth, welcome back.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2043, What this was is we heard this once before. It's allowing the corporate excise tax credit for corporations that provide motor vehicle insurance based on the number of miles that are traveled or time-based rating insurance plans. So it specifies that an eligible corporation must provide motor vehicle insurance policies that are at least 70% based on a mileage-based or time-based rating plan. It's going to limit that corporate tax credit to $100 per vehicle and $300 per policy, and the credit can only be claimed once per policy. It restricts that excise tax credit to $1 million for all tax years beginning January 1st, 2004 and before January 1st, 2009. Now, with your Dash 1 amendment that you have before you today, all this really is doing is there was some discussion last time about eliminating a potential circumstance where one taxpayer could claim the entire $1 million credit but not have sufficient tax liability then to use the full $1 million credit. And the word that is there in the on page 2 of the bill, lines 1 and 2, it's using the word credit claimed. And so that would, you know, leave yourself open where there could be one taxpayer could come in and claim the $1 million credit but not be able to use it all. So this would prevent then other people from not being able to use it. So with the Dash 1 amendment, it's changing the word on line 2 there from claim to allowed. So basically it's just saying that future claims or future credits could be used if the amount that was allowed was less than $1 million in tax liability. So as far as this credit, basically $1 million credit correspond with $100 per vehicle credit, talking basically about 10,000 vehicles that would be insured under the mileage-based and time-based rating insurance plan.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Williams.
If you're ready for a motion, I'll have the Dash 1 amendments.
Let me just see. We also have Dash 4 amendments.
I haven't seen those.
You do?
Dash 4. Matt, do you want to come on up? Oh, do you not have the Dash 4?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry. Could you please bring it, make a quick copy of those? That was my mistake. I thought I had those down here. Matt, if you could go ahead and, well, they're getting copied, if you could tell us what the Dash 4s do.
Sure. For the record, Matt Blevins, Legislative Affairs Director with the Oregon Environmental Council, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee. We are supporting the Dash 4 amendments because they take into consideration a number of comments that we've gotten and feedback we've gotten back from members of the committee and other folks involved in the process. The Dash 4 include the changes that the Department of Revenue asked that was just outlined by committee staff, but it also includes a couple other things. One, it allows the tax credit to be carried forward to a year that the company has tax liability if it does not have any tax liability in the year that it sells the credit, that way allowing folks to take advantage of this when they are profitable if they may not be in the next couple of years. And that was something that we heard back from the business community. It was something that they would want in this type of a tax credit. We also allow the company to sell the tax credits with Department of Revenue review, again, giving them the flexibility that if they feel like they're not in the position to take advantage of it under their current profit status, that they could sell that to a company that is and still be able to take the benefit or the incentive that it's supposed to provide for them to allow this type of a program. And then finally, we, in light of where the budget situation is and the concern about revenue impacts from this and other bills, we have moved back the effective date for this tax credit to go into effect not until the next biennium, basically 2005. So it would not have an impact on the current biennium or the upcoming biennium that everybody has so much concern about in terms of the revenue. So this would push out the effective date from 2005 to 2010 for this tax credit program. Those are the substantive changes that are in the Dash 4.
Okay. Questions for Matt?
Matt, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you. Matt, I have just some notations down here, and if you'll just kind of give me the other side of the story so that I have a good argument to give. In rural Oregon, we already pay less for our insurance. We don't have congestion, and there's a lower risk because of the traffic count. So the question that I have for you, is the answer to this, nothing would change?
nothing would change. One of the reasons why we use this approach as opposed to a different approach is that the feedback we got from both folks across the state as well as the insurance industry is that they didn't want a mandatory policy. Basically, the goal of this type of an approach is to set up a pilot approach for the state and encourage companies to set up that type of a pilot. So the bottom line would be is if you're in a place that you don't think you'd benefit from this type of program, there's nothing that requires you to do that, and you can go on about your life the way you did before.
Okay. And having transit service is not an option in the rural part of the state, what difference would that make?
Again, I think that this is targeted at folks who can take advantage of the program, who either because they may have transit options would be more likely to use those as opposed to drive, or because they, you know, may be elderly and don't have a need to drive as much. They don't need to commute to work every day, but just use their, you know, car on Sunday to go to church, for example. This would be the type of program they'd want to take advantage of. But somebody else who needs to commute daily to work wouldn't need to take advantage of it if they didn't feel like it would benefit them.
I have one more, Mr. Chairman.
You may.
That the insurance company can do this without being offered any kind of care.
Yeah, they can. There's nothing that currently prohibits companies from offering this type of a program. That's true. What we've heard back from the industry in talking to them and trying to work with them to get this to move forward is they have said that because it's such a new program, because there's not a lot of clear actuarial evidence yet about the effectiveness of this program, although there is a lot of other data that supports that this program should work, they're hesitant to sort of jump off in this direction without some hand-holding to go in this direction. And so the intent of the bill is to try to provide them that initial incentive to get them moving in the right direction so that they feel like they're not totally out front by themselves. And that's, again, the approach on this. But, again, it's very short-lived. It's the tax policy is, you know, capped at $1 million. So the intent here is not for an ongoing long-term subsidy, but a just quick boost that hopefully should be able to turn into a longer-term program that everybody can take advantage of if they want to.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
What I'm getting at here is that I think that in rural Oregon, we need to be very supportive of the congestion problem that occurs in other parts of Oregon that we are not faced with, and at the same time that we don't penalize or that we don't treat people in an unfair way in tax policy because of where they live. So that's what I'm trying to kind of focus in on. Okay. Thank you, Matt. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Mayor? Representative Pence.
Thank you. On Section 4 of your Dash 4 amendments, can you explain the intent of selling credits? I understand the reasoning behind you know, carrying this forward as a business tax credits, but if this is a consumer, how would that work mechanically?
For consumers?
Well, I mean, how? Well, just tell me how this would work if you're an insurance company, how this would be traded or sold, as opposed to being able to just carry this forward in years of when you can't use it.
Chair Shetterly, Representative Haas, my understanding on this is that this would work similar to how we set this up with the pollution control tax credit, actually, where you can sell unused tax credits to supplement what you're doing in order to take advantage of the program.
And the insurance company selling it.
Yeah, and so, this is the insurance company, not the consumer. The consumer, in every concept, doesn't actually take advantage of the tax credit. It's the company that's providing.
I guess I meant consumer in the sense that they're...
Right.
But is that... is this sort of boilerplate language for that kind of tax credit thing? Is that
my understanding is it is. Again, I think we took the concept to Ledge Council, and they were the ones who developed the language for us to reflect that. So that my understanding is that's the standard language we would use.
Well, I just was asking because I know we passed that bill for the pollution tax credit last session, the side bill that allowed losses to be carried forward, but it wasn't when selling. And so I was just... I mean, frankly, yeah. It just hits me wrong when I see selling credits to other corporations as opposed to carrying forward when you're so you could use it when you actually do make money, which is I think the language of the pollution tax credit.
Right. Yeah. Again, Chair Shetterly, Representative Haas. I recognize the distinction on that. I guess we felt like because this is a short-term policy. And because the window for this tax credit is only 5 years, we wanted to give as much flexibility to companies to take advantage of the incentive that we're trying to provide as possible, and that if folks were nervous that they weren't going to be able to take advantage of the credit within that five-year window, we wanted to give them that flexibility to figure out ways to do that and still be able to provide the type of policy.
Dexter Johnson, are you here because you're bored, or did you because you heard some conversation that you thought you might be here?
I did hear some.
Okay, come on up.
So, Mr. Chairman, it is always nice to know that there's at least one person watching or hearing. I don't think there's more than one. One person watching or hearing.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My understanding was there's questions about the selling.
Dr. Johnson, Legislative Council.
The
question, Representative Hass had a question just about what language Section 4 is and whether it's boilerplate, I guess.
The intent to trade credits as opposed to being able to carry them forward for a number of years as exists with the pollution tax credit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, it's not what I would call boilerplate by any means. It is there is a procedure in the farm worker housing tax credit. I'd have to go and check to make sure there's a if they can do that with pollution control. That's not my recollection. But you can do that with farm worker housing, and I'm thinking there might be one other one.
There is another housing tax credit, I think, that you can sell. Low income.
Low income.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some other. I mean, this is a concept that I think is gaining in popularity. There's some other drafts that expand the concept of selling unused tax credits and some other bills that are under consideration this session. But it's not what I would call boilerplate by any means.
I guess, Mr. Chair, to me, this in some ways takes away a little bit of the incentive that a carrier might have to do this program, and I may be missing the boat on that, but I think this is a great idea because it raises the public consciousness in terms of driving less. I really think that's the beauty of this bill, and then there's a bonus to people who do drive less on their insurance rates, and so I'm just a little bit hesitant to muddy an otherwise good bill with something that talks about being able to sell this.
Well, let's do this. We've got the Dash 4s that inject this as a new element to the bill. It also changes the revenue impact. Let's, rather than move on this today, maybe we set this down and ask for an industry, maybe an insurance industry representative to come in and talk to us about how they see the sale of tax credits. So we have some understanding, maybe more of both the technical aspect of it and also the market aspect of tax credit trading. Now let's do that. This is a new wrinkle in the bill, and it sounds to me like there may be at least some questions as to how this works, if not questions as to the policy of it. And let's find out before we ask you to vote on that. Okay? All right. Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2043, and we'll finish today with that was a work session, not a public hearing. Thank you, Dexter. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2184, and I will say again, this will be not to move the bill, but we had some amendments that were proposed, and I wanted to give a chance to discuss those. And are these Representative Barnhart's amendments?
Correct.
Well, okay. Another good reason not to move the bill, poor fellow.
How's he doing?
I don't know. Anybody here?
Getting an update?
Still in the hospital.
Still in the hospital. Maybe he's listening to us today. Hi, Phil.
He's really bored.
I sent him some flowers, and on my note, I said, "Been there, done that." All right, Elizabeth, please tell us anyway about the Dash 1 amendments just while we've got this in work session before us today.
Mr. Chairman, with your Dash 1 amendment, just so everyone's clear, this is the bill that was brought forward, pre-session filed by the Department of Revenue. So this is the one that does well with clarifying the date on which Oregon estate taxes are connected with the international of the Internal Revenue Code as of December 31st, 2000. And this for the decedent's dying honor after January 1st, 1998 and before January 1st, 2003. So it really clears up the past. Okay, and it's clarifying then that the date on which Oregon estate tax law is connected to the Internal Revenue Code is as of December 31st, 1996, for descendants dying on or after January 1st, 2003. So going forward, this Dash 1 amendment clearly ties the date then to the Internal Revenue Code as in effect December 31st, 1996 for future deaths in after January 1st, 2003. What this is really meaning is you're connecting and have that threshold amount of $600,000, which is current law. So this basically, with the Dash 1 amendment, makes this bill complete with being current law from a revenue perspective. And the other issues that were also in this bill, just to refresh your memory, was also specifying that an Oregon estate tax return is not required to be filed unless a federal estate tax return is filed. And then in the bill it also has the specific filing thresholds that are needed. So basically for descendants dying on or after January 1st, 2002, for 1 year, it will establish the filing threshold consistent with Internal Revenue Code on December 31st, 2002. So that's the $1 million threshold. And again, this was because this is some of the confusion that was going on and whether or not we were connected with the 97 law changes and then subsequent increase in 2001 to the $1 million. So in 2002, with this bill, you see us connecting from a filing, from the filing threshold that is consistent in the 2001 tax changes, but that's just for 1 year. And then for descendants dying on or after January 2003, then you would see the filing threshold as being, dropping back to $600,000, which would be connecting to IRS code as of December 31st, 1996. So the main thing to remember, I guess, with this bill, and one thing that Department of Revenue brought forward is, you know, there are some administrative issues for them with in the future not being connected with some of the administrative issues that and administrative changes that occurred in the 97 law. So you have that connection here in your Section 3, Subsection 2, where we are saying that for those deaths occurring between January 1st, 1998 and before January 1st, 2003, we are connected with the Taxpayer Relief Act of 97 and other Internal Revenue Service Restructuring Reform Act of 98. But then when we go back and we connect then to pre-97 law changes, then you aren't connected with some of those administrative issues. So one amendment that may help clarify that would just be to say if you would like a filing threshold of $600,000 in the future, then to just allow some of the administrative changes that we could connect to for administrative purposes in the 97 Taxpayer Relief Act of 97 and the Internal Revenue Service Restructuring and Reform Act of 98. So just connect some of those administrative changes, but still keep the filing threshold at $600,000. And the main thing is to be consistent. Like, you know, what you've got here is in Section 7, you've got a filing threshold that is consistent with December 31st, 1996. And then with your Dash 1 amendment, you've got the connection to the pre-96. But the important thing is to keep this threshold at, you know, the pre-97 law changes, but then just allow the administrative changes from the 97 law.
So for decedents dying after, let's say, during the year 2002...
Right.
It says that the threshold is $1 million.
Correct.
That drops under this bill to $600,000 as of January 1, 2003.
Correct.
Mm. What about before 2002 when the federal threshold was, $750,000?
Yeah, we're connecting.
We're connecting it, as for those as well.
Correct. Yeah, we've got those. Okay. We're connecting with 97. Tax law, you know, through the for the deaths January 1st, 1998 and before January 1st, 2003. And then this Section 5 kind of comes in and trumps that for those deaths just in 2002 going up to that million.
That's, you know, it's just interesting. And again, we're not moving this, but what we're doing then is we're establishing a threshold that results in a lower tax burden or tax rate for estates of decedents dying before January 1 of 2003, adopting the $750 and the $1 million. And then we're saying that as of January 1 of 2003, we're dropping that threshold to $600,000, which is, I guess my question is, if we were to go this route, and I'll say I've got some problems with it, but if we were to go this route, is this a three-fifths bill to do that? I mean, it has both elements of going back and lowering the tax on estates retroactively, but then dropping the threshold and so increasing the tax on estates of decedents dying after January 1 of 2003.
Yeah, Chair Shedley, I understand your point, but it really is, you know, up until, you know, 2002, this is current law. You know, this is what the practice was by Department of Revenue.
Well, it's different, though. It wasn't current law. That's what the practice was.
And so I think the point is you wouldn't be collecting. We didn't collect from those taxpayers.
Oh, it's extra.
So it's not such that you're going to have generated any additional revenue from going up like we did.
Well, is there nothing happening on the ward extra? Yeah. Did you understand my question?
Mr. Chair, members of Dexter Johnson Legislative Council, about three-fifths vote?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
Yeah. I don't think it is, because you compare what existing law is, which is the 97, only tied to the 97.
Pre-97.
Right.
Federal law. Right. Compared to what the bill does. So it seems to me you would, if you did nothing,
We would be at 600,000.
Yes.
But I'm just curious, because we are creating this kind of bubble, or yeah, maybe valley, I'm not sure how you look at it, because we're raising the exemption but lowering the tax retroactively for that period of time from January 1 of whatever that, whenever the 750,000, 1998 was added through, and we can do that all, and we can retroactively reduce taxes and then bring them back up all in one bill?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay.
In this situation,
I
think this
will,
is such a unique situation,
yeah,
because at the end of the bill, you're back to where you started. So in that sense, you're not really raising it.
Interesting. Okay.
And I think from a collection point of view, it would be very difficult for the Department of Revenue to go back and get these additional taxes, and so it's really not a revenue impact that's very feasible, even.
Interesting. Okay. Well, like I said, I'm speaking for myself, I got some concerns with this approach, but I thought that was an interesting question that occurred to me over the time. Anybody else want to weigh in on this while we've got House Bill 2184 in front of us? They will not be taking any action on it, but I wanted to get this current so when we bring our inheritance tax bills back in front of us, we'll know what we're talking about. All right. Thank you, Dexter. Thank you, Elizabeth. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2184. And with that, committee, we have concluded our work for the morning. We are adjourned. Have a good 3-day weekend in your districts.